today we've got a special privilege of having Joe Boddy with us. He's the head of the Student Ministry Division here at Xenos, and he's been doing youth work for over 22 years, a good chunk of that in junior high, and now he's moved up to high school and college ministry. And he and his wonderful wife, Cindy, have three kids. The youngest, I think, is in high school now, right? Yeah. So not just his youth work experience, but as a parent, he's got a lot of experience too. We could probably spend the entire morning just asking him questions from things he's learned, but he has something on his mind he'd like to share with you today. So let me pray and we'll bring him up. Well, God, I just thank you for this opportunity to get together with other moms. I know everyone's here because they really care about their kids. They want to do a good job. And so I just really pray that you will encourage everyone today and you will speak to us through Joe and just direct him as he's, you know, encouraging us with some things on his heart. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Thanks, Kim. Well, thanks for, I guess, letting me talk here. And if at all possible, if anybody can move forward, that'd be awesome. That way we can be a little more cozy here. Well, we're going to talk this morning about simple living, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get through all these slides I have and all through the discussion, but we'll give it a try. This has been a real important topic to me, not only because from a youth work perspective, we've seen a lot of families struggle with complicated lives and lives that are entangled in materialism, and it's been real hard on their families. And I think so it's been important for me from that perspective, but also because I've got three kids and I've been interested in this topic as well for my own family. And about a year ago, John McEwen, who is a financial planner, we got together and we came up with this simple living class. It's a three-week class. And so what we're going to talk about this morning is just a very small slice of what that class goes through. And so it was kind of hard trying to figure out how to pare this thing down. So we'll do our best. All right. Simple living is gaining a lot of attention. I mean, I think a lot of you can relate to this. You've got to get the nice house, the nice car, and then, of course, you want to have children who are well-rounded, so you want to get them involved in extracurricular activities, and you're carting them back and forth between their activities, and that gets to be very complicated, and trying to rearrange schedules and coordinate, very difficult. And then, you know, it takes a lot of money to make this happen, so we've got dual-income households, and that's not the easiest thing in the world. And you just wind up completely frustrated, exhausted, and I'm sure a lot of you can relate to this. This is called affluenza. A lot of social scientists have called this affluenza, the American dream turned nightmare. I thought that was a good way to term it. And this affluenza is a painful, contagious, socially transmitted condition of overload, debt, anxiety, and waste resulting from the dogged pursuit of more. Affluenza causes overconsumption, luxury fever, consumer debt, overwork, waste, and harm to the environment. These pressures lead to psychological disorders, alienation, and distress. This is from a book called Affluenza, When Too Much is Never Enough. I'm going to try to speak from a biblical Christian perspective. So just know that as we get into this. And I think this is, affluenza is nothing more than just flat, bare, raw materialism. That's really all it is. And I think a lot of us have, you know, our culture is steeped in this. And as Christians, it's important for us to stop, take a look at what's happening to our culture and maybe what's happening to our own lives and just try to assess things and do our best along those lines. Our outline today, let's try to cover three things. I'd like to try to unmask materialism for what it really is and some of the damage it causes. And then to try to put together a working definition of simple living, what it really is, because there's a lot of definitions out there as to what simple living is. And then talk a little bit about simple living in our own families. Well, we need to realize, first of all, that materialism can't make us happy. The acquiring goods and money and achievement isn't going to work. Consider, this is a quote from a book called The High Price of Materialism by Kasser. He cites a study, and this is a sociological study. It's very scholarly. He's got a bazillion studies in this book, that research studies that different people have done that he's brought into the book. And he says, consider, for example, the research of Edward Diner, who followed the happiness and life satisfaction of almost 5,000 United States adults over a 9-year period. Some of these adults experienced large increases in wealth over the 9 years. This was a longevity study they conducted. Some had only moderate increases, and others barely kept up with the rising cost of living. And regardless, changes in income were not significant predictors of individuals' current happiness and life satisfaction. And they have all these studies on, scientific studies on how they can measure people's level of happiness. And it's very scholarly. Here's another study he drew on. This study shows that as income rises, that's the rising bar up there, that has no effect on people's personal happiness. In fact, personal happiness actually goes down a little bit the more money you make. And that just is so, opposite of the way we view things. We think, I just need this next thing, and then I'll be happy. And then once we get that, we think, okay, the next thing, then I'll be happy. But we need to realize it has no effect on personal happiness. In fact, it may have a negative effect on our personal satisfaction. Okay, I want to take a look at this program. This is, I forget the name, I don't know if it was 60 Minutes. I can't remember. Somebody knows in this room knows what the name of this program is. Is it 60 Minutes? Okay. They did a little thing on the life of Tom Brady. Has anybody familiar with this little spot? Okay, so this ought to be real interesting. Here we go.
Tom Brady, the quarterback of the New England Patriots, is not only one of the NFL's best players, he's one of the NFL's best stories. At the tender age of 28, he's already won 3 Super Bowls, an accomplishment that ranks him with some of the best quarterbacks ever to play the game.
I mean, you go from the backup quarterback to winning the Super Bowl in 5 months. I mean, you can't write that. You can't. There's no script for that. I mean, it's just...
Brady has been dating Hollywood actress Bridget Moynihan for 2 years. Besides his good looks and all of the success, there is a $60 million 10-year contract to play for the Patriots.
For me, I mean, I'm making more money now than I ever thought I could ever make playing football.
He's turned down multi-million dollar endorsement deals because he didn't think they were right for him. And many of the ones he's doing, he shares with his teammates.
You guys have to go everywhere with me.
But with all that money, fame, and career accomplishments, we were surprised to hear this from him.
Why do I have 3 Super Bowl rings and still think there's something greater out there for me? I mean, maybe a lot of people would say, hey, man, this is what it is. I reached my goal, my dream, my life is me. I thank God. It's got to be more than this.
What's the answer?
I wish I knew. I wish I knew.
Wow, how about that? That is incredible. This was a few years ago, so. Yeah, it doesn't make us happy. In fact, affluenza, materialism, it really takes its toll on our relationships, too. This came from Kasser's book. Evidence substantiate the claim that when people highly value wealth, possession, status, and image, the emphasis they place on interpersonal relationships and contributions to their community declines. And I think that's obvious. When you focus on money and accomplishment, you're not going to focus on relationships and people. There's only so much the human can focus on. What a nice picture of J. Paul Getty. Wow. one of the richest people that has ever lived. Here's what he had to say at the very end of his life. I hate to be a failure. I hate and regret the failure of my marriages, and he had many. I would gladly give all my millions for just one lasting marital success. Wow. Yeah, it takes its toll on relationships. And materialism also is very raw. Check out this. This is a quote from Wayne Chalicki, executive of General Mills. Here's what he had to say. When it comes to targeting kid consumers, we at General Mills follow the Procter & Gamble model of cradle to grave. We believe in getting them early and having them for life. And he's talking about your kids. These advertisers are after your kids, and they know exactly what they're doing and how to get your kids. This is from Mike Searles, president of Kids R Us. Here's what he had to say. All these advertising people understand something that is very basic and logical, that if you own this child at an early age, you can own this child for years to come. Wow. You walk into a store with your kid, and there's a whole cache of strategy behind that. They know what they're doing, and they want your kid. And this is something, as people who are interested in trying to live simply, this is something you're just going to have to fight against. And you're just going to have to say, no, we can't do that. And it's you're just going to have to be standing against your whole culture. America spent $500 billion on advertising in just 2008. That is more than 134 countries' combined GNP. Yeah. So you're going to have to do some standing and some resisting if you want to be able to live simply. It takes its toll on families. This is a study. It's called Overscheduled Kids, Underconnected Families, The Research. It's by William Doherty, PhD, Family Social Science Department of the University of Minnesota. This study has gained a lot of popularity, and it's a study that many scholars are drawing on. This study shows that there's been a cultural shift in the last 20 years. Everyone is busier, and I guess I don't really need to tell you that. But let's look at some stuff here. It's real interesting. In this study, they measured kids ages 3 to 12 from a 15-year period or a 16-year period from 1981 to 1997. And there's been a massive cultural shift in the lives of the American family. And he goes to outline it in a few different categories. First of all, a decline in kids' free time, 12 hours a week in that 16-year period. A decline in kids' free time. That is a lot. 12 hours a week. Oh, my God. That's like 2 hours a day for a kid who doesn't have free time. That is massive. Why? Number one, structured sports have doubled from 2 hours and 20 minutes per week back in 1981 to 5 hours and 17 minutes a week in 1997. And I'm sure it might even have doubled since then. I'm sure we've added on a couple more hours at least since that time. So this is a huge cultural shift. And passive spectator sports have increased from 30 minutes a week back in 1981 to now 3.5 hours per week. And that's in 1980. I'm sure this has increased. And what this means is Junior gets dragged along to his brother's baseball game, and he has to sit there and watch. And so it's really not free time. And this does not include screen time. This is just Junior getting dragged along to his sibling's activity. At the same time, homework has increased by 50%. Wow. Let alone mom and dad having to run their kids all over creation to get them to their activity. A decline in family participation in this 16-year period. Conversations. Children average about 45 minutes per week in conversation with anyone in the family when the conversation was the primary activity. That's just sitting around at the kitchen table and hanging out 6 minutes a day. And I forgot to put on there what the decline was, but that's not very much. And I believe this number has decreased probably substantially since 1997 as well. I don't believe that many families are getting this. Too busy. How about this? Vacations have declined by 28% over two decades in the number of families taking vacations. Now, wait a minute. I thought at the development of the PC, the computer age, that it was supposed to help us get our work done quicker so that we would have more time for leisure, more time with the families. But you know what? The exact opposite of happens is because we're materialists and we're like, oh, well, I can get ahead. I'm going to use this savings of time to get more done so that I can get ahead. This right there is sad because today we are the richest country that has ever existed. We should be able to take time with our families on vacations. This is ridiculous. And why don't people go on vacations? It's because they don't. I tell you what, these coaches of all these sports teams, I know this for a fact. They're like, no, you cannot go out of town because we're gonna start this practice in August. You're not allowed to go. No, oh, well, if you do go, well, then I guess you're gonna have to. You just won't get that much playing time. And so there's a lot of pressure to make these kids stay in whatever extracurricular activity it is, and to get them producing. Family meal time declined by 10% in that 16-year period. And I believe it's declined probably another 10% in the last 10 years. Family dinners declined 33% over three decades in families who say they definitely have dinner together regularly as a whole family. In a 1995 national poll, only one-third of U.S. families said they usually have their evening meal together on a daily basis. We can't because, you know, practices are scheduled during dinner time. Kids don't get home until, you know, I don't know, 6:30, 7 o'clock, and then they have to do their homework. It's not just in our minds. This is a Lou Harris poll. He's a famous pollster. He says, it's not just in our minds. Lou Harris conducted a poll comparing what happened in the American workplace in 1988 with 15 years earlier. The average work week jumped from 41 to 47 hours. For those in management, it soared to the range of 52 to 59 hours per week. During that same period, actual leisure time shrunk 37%. Add to this the pressure of two career families or the incredible weight of running a single-parent household, and the result is that many people are living in what I refer to as crisis mode. I think a lot of people are now getting fed up with this, and they're starting to take notice, and I think that's good. There's also, because of this frantic pace that we're keeping, a decline in religious participation. A 40% decline in hours per week in children's religious participation. Why? Why is that? Well, I mean, you are running ragged the whole week, and by Sunday, you're exhausted. You're not going to get up and go to church. There's no way. You're going to want to sleep in and finally have a little bit of leisure time. For high school students, a 24% decline with weekly religious attendance from 40% in 1981 to 31% in 1997. And believe me, we're really feeling this in our ministry where it's really hard to get kids out because they're busy doing all these extracurricular activities. And when you talk to them, they're just like, I just don't have the time. And you're like, you do too have the time. And then you think about it and you start adding up everything and you're just like, yeah, you're too busy. You're busy with stuff. Probably be a good idea to shed some of that extracurricular stuff off your schedule. It's taking our toll on our kids, though. We talked about this on Monday night. Did anybody here in this room come to that screening that we showed of Race to Nowhere? Raise your hand. Yeah, so you get what I'm talking about. Madeline Levine wrote this book called Price of Privilege. She's a secular psychiatrist, real sharp woman. And here's what she had to say. America's newly identified at-risk group is preteens and teens from affluent, well-educated families. In spite of their economic and social advantages, They experience among the highest rates of depression, substance abuse, anxiety disorders, somatic complaints, and unhappiness of any group of children in the country. Yeah. And there's been a whole host of books written by secular authors. We're not getting a whole lot from Christians on this, and I find that to be really interesting. I just can't believe this. But these guys are right on the money, and I've included a book list here with these books, as well as several others that you might find helpful. Yeah, we're teaching kids how to cheat in school to get the grade. Here's what she says. Wealthy parents are driving their kids to succeed, to achieve, eventually. Why? It's to land a scholarship in a prestigious college so that the kid can get the really good job and make the big money and be a success. And as you know, as parents, you don't want your kids falling behind. I don't want my kids falling behind. I'm very concerned. I want my kids to succeed. And I want them to do as good as their peers. But at the same time, it's creating a culture of unethical cheating and damaged kids. And one point that Levine makes in her book early on is that these kids, and these are, I'm talking about high school kids, by the time they get into high school, they have no idea who they are. The only thing they know is I have to achieve, achieve, achieve. And they don't enjoy life. They hate it. Life is just seen as one accomplishment after another. And it's not like they're learning. Some of these books also point out in that movie, so aptly put it, these kids aren't even learning anything. And then when they do land that scholarship in the prestigious school, guess what? They have to go through a year of remediation because all they did was learn how, all they learned was how to take tests. They didn't learn the information. They didn't learn how to critically think. All they learned was how to take tests. And once they took the test, the information was gone out of their mind. So it's really taking its toll on our kids. Now, that was the movie we saw. This is a great, I think they're going to probably release this film in June or July. And so if you haven't seen this film, I would highly recommend going out and seeing it. Oh, I can't read this, but this was a letter that my son got last year. Last year he was in eighth grade. He got a letter from this company that's doing college admissions assistance. And so they're trying to strike fear into, and they're saying in this letter, well, you know, you really need to be thinking about college now and which college you're going to get into, how much financial aid you're going to get, and this and that, and trying to scare you into thinking along these lines. And the kid was 14 years old, for God's sakes. This is ridiculous. We need, if we want to live simply, we need to stand against this kind of crap. And I think what we're involved with our culture is competitive parenting. I think that's what Tom Dixon has aptly put it. And this is where we become competitive parents because we don't want our kids falling behind. And so we push our kids to achieve, achieve, achieve because we want them to succeed. So let's maybe have a little bit of discussion. Why does competitive parenting seem beneficial? What are some of the reasons we think that getting our kids to achieve can be a good thing? And anybody have any thoughts on that? Yeah.
And the way of our culture, getting your goals and achieving them and moving on to the next thing, and whatever those goals are, whether they're material or emotional or whatever. So it's part of teaching your children to go after what they want.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's definitely what seems to be a very legitimate reason is to teach our kids how to say, hey, they're going to have to get there this is what they're going to be dealing with in the real world, so we might as well start them when they're young.
Yeah, I would even say that as Christian parents, we can even kind of put a Christian spin on it. Like, my child has gifts, and they're God-given gifts, and I'm just trying to help him you know, make the most of those gifts so he can serve God with those gifts. And, you know, I can totally just sort of Christianize my drivenness with my kids.
Absolutely. Great point. I've heard that a number of times. Any other thoughts on that? I'll throw out some and see if you can resonate with this. Well, how about this one? It keeps my kids busy and out of trouble. Yeah, helps me to produce good kids. If they're busy enough, then they're not going to have a lot of idle time to run with a bad crowd. Exactly. I was talking to there was a high schooler who his family kept him so busy with sports, and this is the excuse they used, but little did they know that this kid was just doing all kinds of massive drugs with his wrestling buddies, and his whole spiritual life went to hell in a handbasket. And so we talked to the parents and said, look, what about these sports? This kid is just not doing well spiritually. He's just completely checked out. We're worried about him. Well, and, you know, have you considered not putting him in so many sports? No, because it keeps him out of trouble. And you're just like, he is in massive trouble right now. And he's doing drugs with all his wrestling buddies. And so, yeah, I think those are some seemingly legitimate reasons. Yeah, would you say are the marks of a competitive parent? What do you think characterizes their life?
Anxiety,
definitely.
Winning.
Absolutely. That was a great point. I want my kid, I don't want them to be left behind. I want them to do well compared to their peers. Yeah. Anybody else? Sherry?
I think just asking about their achievements. So you're always asking, what are you doing in the next thing?
Right. In the movie we saw Monday night, the competitive parent was always, did you get your homework done? What do you have for homework? Is there a test you need to study for? Or, well, I got an A on my test. And then the competitive parent says, and? What else did you achieve? You know, it's like, what are you achieving? Great. Yes?
Another one is when I try to say, hey, you want to hang out, grab a coffee with a parent? I can't. We've got volleyball this night. Johnny has a baseball game on Wednesday. And it's nonstop for months.
Awesome. When it comes into when it starts encroaching on your ability to have adult relationships, yeah, you know that you might be heading that way toward being a competitive parent. Awesome. Thank you. Yeah. What would you say are the real goals of a competitive parent? Awesome. Make me feel good about myself, or make me look better. And what did you say?
So that other people think they're doing a good job. Look at me.
So other people think that I am doing a good job. Look at me. Awesome. Exactly. Other maybe sort of core reasons for competitive parenting. Yes.
Distract with having to deal with your kids, maybe. Like, oh, that, you know, you're just taking them places and, you know, getting their energy out, but you aren't really, like, taking time to get to know your kids and deal with the problems they have.
Yeah, I think that may be true, that it's a lot easier to let other people parent our kid and ship our kids off so that we don't have to deal with some of the tougher things of child raising. Yeah. Yes.
Something similar is just not really knowing what to do. You kind of have bought into the lie that surrounds us, and you think that it's going to get you somewhere or that's going to get your kid somewhere.
Right. Flat out, you give to her, flat out materialism. If I can get my kid to achieve and get that college degree, you know, get that really good college degree at a good school, then that means my kid is going to get a good job and he'll be happy. He'll be having as good as I have it or better. And it's just really basically materialism, looking toward money to making us happy. And so when you just start that level and work your way backwards, it really comes to thinking that we are going to be happy by gaining accomplishment and money and things. Also give us freedom from anxiety. I don't have to worry about my kid then. Yeah, good. Here's a quote from the Apostle Paul talking to his disciple Timothy, and he said, "But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many a pang." Very, very true. We've seen a lot of this. Well, okay. We realize the culture we live in, it's a highly materialistic, complicated society there. Let's talk about what it might mean to live more simply. Well, okay, now, last February, just over a year ago, ABC World News did a special on what cities are the happiest cities in the United States. And Holland, Michigan was one of those, was the second. Holland, Michigan ranks second on the well-being index, topping Honolulu. Well, the interesting thing is, so people in Holland, Michigan apparently have a higher rate of satisfaction than almost every other city in the United States. And the interesting thing is, Holland, Michigan is one of the most economically depressed cities in the country. And so ABC News is like, now wait a minute, this doesn't really seem to add up. They are one of the poorest cities in the whole nation, and yet they're the second happiest city in the nation. So they came up with the reasons why, and here's what ABC News discovered. They are a city of churches, so people are spiritually minded. They want to find out what God's will is for their lives. They have a culture of giving. Now, wait a minute. Poorest cities in the world, but yet they give. They have like one of the highest rates of per capita giving to charity in the nation. Community spirit. So they really believe in community, in relationships. And see, I think this is what gets at simple living. This is what we're looking for. We're looking for people. If we want to live more simply, I think we're going to have to look toward God and His will for our lives. And then outward, giving to other people. That's what makes us happy. And doing it with other people, having a community. Yeah. And these are intrinsic values. These are eternal values that I think we are created in the image of God. We were meant to live for this. And so I think we should be thinking along these lines when we think of simple living. Is it financial freedom? Well, first of all, I'm not even sure if there is such a thing. Is there such a thing as financial freedom? I'm not sure there is. But a lot of simple living authors are talking about this kind of thing. Here is Janet Lewis. Simplify your life, relax, enjoy, breathe. You've just found the most straightforward path to becoming financially free, clutter-free, and debt-free ever. With the Total Simplicity Program for only $59.95, you can. And so a lot of simple living proponents have gone this way to just try to rid yourself of debt and focus on that and try to get yourself free, financial freedom. Yet, I think at the same time, that can require such a focus that it's just the flip side of materialism. It's materialism from a different angle. And I'm not sure that's going to get the job done. I think, trying to eliminate some debt is good, but I don't think that's quite the answer. Other simple living proponents want us to live simply to save our health and save the planet because, our footprint that we're leaving on this earth in this last few decades is enormous. And we are basically destroying the earth. And so I think this is good. We want to live more simply so we can be better stewards of the creation that God has put us in. Here is an author, Dr. J. Matthew Sleeth. He wrote a book called Serve God, Save the Planet. Very challenging book, I think. And he said, over the past 5 years, my wife, uses less than one-third of the fossil fuels and one quarter of the electricity we once used. We've gone from leaving two barrels of trash by the curb each week to leaving one bag every few weeks. We no longer own a clothes dryer, garbage disposal, dishwasher, or lawnmower. So this guy has just gone crazy. And he's a doctor, so it's not, I mean, he has means. He's another guy that moved out of a multi-million dollar home and moved into a less expensive home. And so he's gone the whole nine yards on this. But again, I think this is good. We want to be better stewards. But if our focus becomes entirely on this, I think that, let's look at what the Apostle Peter says. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief. The heavens will disappear with a roar. The elements will be destroyed by fire. And the earth and everything done in it will be laid bare. Since everything will be destroyed in this way, what kind of people ought you to be? You ought to live holy and godly lives. So this whole world that we're living in is going to be destroyed anyway. Now, I'm not saying that that should be license for us to destroy the earth the way we are. I'm just saying that if we want to live more simply just to save the planet, I think that's a bad goal. I think we should live more simply to be better stewards, but I don't think that takes it far enough. And I think it can be an over-consuming focus that you can't focus on relationships as much. Well, my friend wants to hang out, and she's been trying to get hangout time with me for a few months, but I can't because I don't have a dishwasher, so I got to do the dishes by hand. Or, you know, I got to, you know, put the clothes on the laundry line. And I think this can get to be so consuming. Some of the measures are good, but I'm not sure it gets it. Now, this was written by a Christian woman. She defines Christian living in this book mostly as reducing stress and gaining more quality, quantity and quality family time. And again, I think this is good. But on the other end, it can turn real inward, and I don't think it gets quite at the question of simple living. I think simple living, and this is a definition that John McEwen and I came up with, was living more simply so that we can serve God more fully. Yeah, here's an awesome quote from Jesus Christ. He said, "But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these other things shall be added to you." So when we make Jesus Christ our goal and serving him, then he adds progress to financial freedom, saving our health and our environment, reducing stress, getting more and better family time. I'm not saying we're going to just get perfected in all these areas, and I'm not even saying financial freedom is possible. I'm just saying that he's the one that is going to help all the other dominoes to fall rightly in our lives. The key question is, will simplifying enable me to increase my service to God? And you know, it works. We've got Holland, Michigan as a great example for that. And here's a pretty interesting quote from Kasser. "Compared with materialistic people, those who believe in intrinsic values are relatively important, report enhanced happiness, greater psychological health, better interpersonal relationships, more contributions to community, and more concern for ecological issues. These findings are substantiated by research conducted with various age and cultural groups." This is like study after study. People who focus on intrinsic values are happier people. Yeah, so it really, really works. Now let's talk about simple living in families. Boy, and I'm not sure how long I've gone here. Well, hopefully I won't go that long. All right. Well, I think that as we look at simple living with our families, one thing we want to make sure happens is that we develop a close relationship with our kids. I think that's a priority right there. And we also, though, at the same time, we want to help our kids develop a growing relationship with God. Got to have that. But we don't want it to stop there. We want them, as they have a growing relationship with God, we want to help our kids become givers, not takers. Yeah. we know that that's what's going to make them happy. And so we have to live simply enough. We have to live simple lives so that we can get that done. But when we are too busy running kids all over the place, when we're too busy trying to get into that next better car, it's going to be harder and harder to get the job done along those lines. And so we must trim back. We must live more simply so that we can be more relational with our family and so that we can be more spiritually minded with our family and take the time. I know when I'm busy and I'm running around, I don't have the time to deal with my kids' anxiety and turn them to God. I don't have time to sit and listen to really how their day went because I'm running around and they're running around. And so we have to trim back in order to be more relational and lead our kids spiritually. So important. And now is the time, I think most of you have young children, now is the time to get this going if you haven't started. It's too late when they're older. So let's talk about developing a close relationship with our kids. Here's a quote from the authors Chapman and Campbell from the Five Love Languages of Children. He said, in raising children, everything depends on the love relationship between parent and child. Nothing works well if a child's love needs are not met. Only the child who feels genuinely loved and cared for can do her best. Yeah, so love relationship with your kids is where it's at. But when you're too busy to have it, when you're too busy, it erodes your ability to have love relationship with your kids. This is from Randall Day. He did a longevity study of parenting. He says that having a disengaged parent, even though he or she may be physically present, is very problematic with regard to early problem behaviors with substance abuse. It's funny, you got the dad with the newspaper in front. Dad, I got to talk to you about something. Huh? Adults whose fathers had been highly involved when they were children were more tolerant and understanding and engaged in more socially responsible behavior than those with less involved fathers. Yeah, so we got to get our husbands involved and got to get dad involved. I thought this was interesting. This is from Radden, a study that he did. Toddlers who must work out for themselves how to achieve goals such as retrieving a ball that is just out of reach in their father's hand or wrestling their father to the ground are practicing important problem-solving skills. Interesting. In fact, when fathers are good at playing with their young children, these children score higher on tests of thinking and problem-solving skills. You have got to be kidding me. You mean normal wrestling around on your knees on the floor is good for a kid's thinking? Yes, it is. In fact, it's better than anything else you can do for a young kid. It's good old-fashioned play. This is what helps develop improved pathways with the brain, improved thinking, right there. Well, what about soccer tots for toddlers age 20 months or older? And there is such a thing. So you're going to get your 1.5-year-old playing soccer with a bunch of other 1.5-year-olds on a team. And maybe I should do that because, you know, I want him to get good. I don't want him to get left behind, right? So I'm going to put him in, and plus I'm working and I'm too busy, so, you know, this might be good. Gymnastics program for kids at almost any age, even infants and toddlers, like at the little gym. Yeah, so I'm going to get my infant doing gymnastics. Perfect. Now, this doesn't help at all. In fact, studies show that this actually hurts kids. Won't my child fall behind everyone else? No, they will not fall behind everyone else. Good old-fashioned relational play is what kids need. Well, but can't I make my child's brain develop faster? I remember when I had kids 20 years ago, my sister, who's a little bit older, she was trying to give me some older sister bossy advice. She gave me a call and she said, now, I just read this stuff where you need to get your kids, your infants, Michelle, and this is back in 1990, you got to get her listening to Mozart and Beethoven because that is going to develop new and better brain function. because Mozart and Beethoven were geniuses, and it really can, studies show it really can make your kids smarter. And I really don't know what study he was referring to, because there is no such study. But Disney says they said differently. So they came out, have you guys heard of Baby Mozart? DVDs and maybe even music CDs. But they were convincing all of the world to try to get your kid, as an infant, to start watching these DVDs, and that your kid would become smarter. That's why they call them the Baby Einstein videos. And so these were just humongous sellers and bought up by everybody. And this is what my sister was getting at. Not true. In fact, studies now are showing that it hurts kids. It makes them too fragmented to put them in front of a TV. Getting your infant, getting your 1-2-year-old in front of the TV actually causes more them to lose attention span, ability to have attention span, makes them more diffuse. What they need is mom and dad to play with them. That's what they need. In fact, the Baby Einstein videos had to be recalled because of false advertising. There is no proof. The Baby Einstein recall is a tacit admission that the products do not increase infant intellect. And that happened a few years ago. So these marketers are just, they know what parents' fears are. And so they're going to go after you based on what they think your fears are. We've got to stand against this if we want to live simple lives. The importance of nurture and attachment. Without love, a child will starve emotionally and can become impaired for life. A great deal of research indicates that the emotional foundation of life is laid in the first 18 months of life, particularly the mother-child relationship. The food for future emotional health is physical touch, kind words, tender care, not putting him in front of a TV, not putting the headphones on him and making him listen to Beethoven. I don't know why we always think we had it better than parents who, 200 years ago. As a baby develops a relationship with his or her mother and father, he comes to prefer them to other adults in a process known as attachment. Psychologists agree that babies with secure attachments to their parents have better chances to develop into happy, successful, well-adjusted children and adults. It's just good old-fashioned, tender, loving care. But if we're living complicated lives and we're rushing around, it's going to be harder and harder to get to that. Now, those are all the footnotes. So I think practically it's important, especially the first few years of our kids' lives, to try to keep mom at home. Typically, mothers are more nurturing than fathers are. And, I think it's just the way God designed us. I think that's something we should really work toward. Go easy on organized activities. They don't really accomplish that much. There are some good things to organize activities. But go easy. Make sure it's not encroaching on your family time and making sure you're still able to have a relationship with your kids. Limit the screen time. Very important. I mean, I think this is true up through middle school and even into high school. Try to limit your kids' screen time. It doesn't do them a whole lot of good. Some ideas. Family dinners most every night. I think that's important. Studies show that families who have dinner together, actually the kids do much better than families who don't. The kids are more well-adjusted, and it gives them an outlet to talk about their day. Fun family nights with games. So you need to have at least one night after dinner where your family is just there together, just your family, and you're hanging out most of the night before the kids go together. You know, you're playing a game. Monopoly was always our favorite. We figured out a faster way to play Monopoly, and so that you can get that game in, in an hour or less. If you need any insight on that, you can come and talk to me. There's all kinds of board games that your kids need to learn how to play, cards, all kinds of make-believe games you can do. I guess we'll talk about that in a little bit. Take vacations. I mean, even if it's just somewhere, you don't have to go to anywhere extravagant. You can get creative and come up with real inexpensive vacations. It's just important that you get away from the phone, away from the city, and get out somewhere where you can be just hang out as a family. Ooh, one-on-one time with each kid. Mom and Dad, I think we should live simple enough lives to where we can get Mom and Dad each spending their own individual time with each of the kids every week, or at least every other week. So I've got three kids, and every week I had a date with each one of my kids. And I got this from Holly and Dennis McCallum. And it's usually a couple, 2 or 3 hours per kid. And it's awesome. And so if you can trim your life back to where you can get your one-on-one time, and my wife Cindy did this too with all three of our kids. And so there was some rearrangement of the schedule so that we could make sure that we each got our time with our kids. But to this day, it's awesome. To this day, my kids are still like, well, we're still doing our date, right? And my kids are 21, 18, and 15. And so they still look forward to our date together. And it's really helped build our relationship. Yeah. I have talked to so many dads about this over the years. Are you getting your one-on-one time? Is it scheduled? Is it in the schedule every week, same time every week? Oh, no, haven't gotten to that yet. Been busy. And I'm telling you what, man, you will never regret the sacrifices you made to spend one-on-one time with your kid. Yeah.
As a father, give me some examples of what you do.
Right here. Boom. See, I've even got it down to the ages, 1 to 8. This obviously is not an exact science. I'm just trying to give you some practical thoughts here. Make-believe is so awesome. Man, I remember we had this game when the kids were little called, we had a lot of little make-believe games. But one of them was called Lion King. When my kids were little, the movie Lion King was out. And I was always the mean lion, Scar. And they were always the good lions, Simba and Nala. And we would get on our knees, and I would chase after them, roaring and stuff. And I'd try to deceive them and trick them, just like Scar does on the movie. And they would just run around all over, screaming and running away from me. We had another game called Defeat Monster. And that's where I would get on down on all fours. And then the goal was they had to take their shoes off and their socks. And the goal was for them to run around and me to try to slap their foot as hard as I could. And so they'd be running around just like, wah, wah, wah. And the couch was the base. So if they got on the couch, I couldn't touch them. But they only had a 10-second limit on the couch, so they'd have to get off and run around. And that was just a game that we managed to get about 5 or 6 years out of that game. And it was really good. So a lot of make-believe. Crafts. Dads and moms can do crafts. Low-key sports, I don't recommend the intense traveling sports teams. I think those are not beneficial. Maybe some rec league sports. Those are less demanding. They're not as competitive. They're fun. Crafts, crafts are great. I remember when Jenny was about 8, we tried to build this. We had gerbils, so we did a lot of things with animals. We tried to build this homemade gerbil maze, and it was a disaster. But it was fun. It was so much fun. And my wife was really good with crafts, so she taught them that at a young age. Building things. I used to take my kids all the time to the animal farms, the one up on by Don Scott Field. We'd go look at the pigs, look at the horses.
When you say low-key sports,
when you say low-key sports, sorry, you mean them actively playing. You don't mean them carpooling them, watching them for the 45-minute practice, and bringing them home, correct?
I'm not sure what your question is.
She's asking you if, when you're saying low-key sports with your children, is this for your date nights?
Oh, no, this is, I'm sorry, this is not, well, Okay, that is a little bit confusing. You're right. I don't know why I put that up there, actually. Maybe coaching. Maybe you could coach, but let's
wrestling
change that
ground,
to just
maybe
doing stuff at home, sports with your kids at home. Now, I'm glad you brought that. I'm not sure why that's never come up before. Good point.
Like throw a football or play basketball 1-on-1 or something.
Yeah, I think that would be, that's a better take on it, yeah. Just backyard sports with your kids. Taking them out in nature and trying to teach them about nature, doing a little research yourself. Yeah. Camping is real good. Yeah.
I was going to say, even around here, there's great.
Oh, yeah. And what you want to do is you want to stop and actually look at something and look at the little insect on the ground and then try to then go back home, look it up on the web, and try to show your kid what it is on the web. There's all kinds of things you can do like that. Girls, crafts are good at this mid-range. This would be ages 9 to 14. Crafts still works. Good stuff there. Boys, guns work really well. Real good. BB guns. Music. You want to, maybe you could do cell group with your kid. Camping still works. Out to eat. Now, here's the interesting thing. As we talk about simple living, we're always talking about, you always hear, well, you've got to save money and you try not to spend money. But see, a lot of times I don't think that's necessarily the right approach when it comes to spending time with your kids. I think you should spend the money on that. And so when we talk about simple living, we're talking about prioritizing. And so I think that you are going to have to spend a little money to take your kid out and get some alone time, not just staying at home, because when they get to be in that mid-range age, they start to get distracted with things at home. And so you got to take them out somewhere to get them alone so you can have a relationship and talk. Somewhere around 7, 8, 9 years old, you want to start to make sure your kids are developing hobbies. So that's good. Now, so those are some ideas. Anybody who wants this PowerPoint outline, you can go ahead and email me. My email is, we'll just do bodyj, BOTTIJ, at xenos.org. And I'll go ahead and send this PowerPoint outline to you. It's important, though, as we try to build a relationship, not to overindulge. Parents often inadvertently confuse love with overindulgence. They don't want their children to suffer a moment of frustration or be deprived of any desire. I think that would be the wrong approach to overindulge. Adults with the greatest emotional difficulties were generally overgratified, overprotected, and overindulged as children. I believe that's true. Now, okay, let's go back here. The goal, let's think about the goal. When we are raising kids, we want them at age 18 to have a good amount of internal control and independence. We don't want to have to be telling them what to do when they're 18, do we? I mean, that's going to be bad. You know, did you eat your cereal today? Did you do your laundry? You know, we don't want to be in that position when the kid is 18. We want them to have enough inner control where they can make their own decisions and be more independent. Now, it's when they're younger that we want to exert the external control. We want to give them discipline because, I mean, why would you want to give a little kid a bunch of independence and trust them to make their own decisions? I mean, that's why we're there. That's why we're parents. That's why God put us there, so we can guide our children. And they do need to be disciplined, and they do need our control, right? Now, I've noticed something in our church and in the culture at large that we're getting things a little bit backwards. My observations is that we're giving little Jimmy too much freedom, and we're overindulging them. And, oh, honey, okay, yeah, we'll go to McDonald's. Or would you rather go to Burger King? Or, okay, would you rather have a small soda or would you rather have a large soda? And, you know, we're just letting these kids make all these decisions, and I think that's a bad idea. So, and we won't discipline them. Now, it's when they're young that you need to discipline them. By the time they get to be 18, if we've gone with this model, we're going to be in a world of hurt. We're going to have to tell our kids how to live their lives, but it's not going to work because it's too late. If they, if they haven't developed internal control and independence by the time, you know, and we try to start to control them at that age, it just doesn't work. So let's try to remember not to get this backwards, because that's what's going to happen. Yeah. Here's some really cool proverbs. Do not hold back discipline from the child. Although you beat him with the rod, he won't die. Give him a glass of milk instead of the soda. He'll live. Poverty and shame will come to him who neglects discipline, but he who regards reproof will be honored. And there's a lot more proverbs on discipline, but yeah. We need to also, as we try to raise our kids simply, we need to help them develop a growing relationship with God. Parents, God live it if we want to give it. How true is that? Matthew 6:33, seek first his kingdom. And then Proverbs 22, verse 6, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Now, the word train here is real interesting. Now, for one thing, it's a real harsh word that means break into submission a wild horse with a rope in a mouth. And God is saying, you know, that's kind of what your kids are like. They are born wild animals, and you've got to control them. And it's really true. You know, if you had a little kid who's 2 years old, and he wants a toy, and he, you know, fights his little two-year-old friend, and they fight over that toy. If your little two-year-old had a gun and knew how to use it, he'd shoot that other two-year-old. I mean, our kids are born fallen creatures, sinful creatures. So we have to teach them submission. But the other term for train up here is real interesting, I thought. And this came from Chuck Swindoll. He said it's a strategy of midwives to help newborns develop thirst for breastfeeding. It's a Hebrew term. The midwives would help the mother deliver their baby. And when the baby was born, the midwife would dip her finger in these crushed dates, the fruit, and then put her finger in the newborn infant's mouth, and immediately the infant would start sucking on it because it tasted good, and it would teach the kid how to breastfeed. And the point here is training up is not only just like, you know, I'm going to discipline you, but it's also, I'm going to make you want to follow God. I'm going to make you want to thirst for God. And as parents, if our lives are alive with God and we're excited about God, that's going to create a thirst in our kids to want God. How exciting would it be that your kids really, really want God? That's what he's talking about there. And so we need to embrace our role here as parents and not abdicate it to the youth group, not abdicate it to other people. That's our job. God told Moses, in these words which I'm commanding you today shall be on your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. In other words, God is saying, man, I want you to teach them about me all the time. Yeah, it's you. You have to do this, not the youth group. This is your job as a parent. Some ideas. Ooh, these are fun. These are awesome things to do with your kids. Nighttime routine. I'm sure, you know, I'm probably preaching to the choir here, but just in case, here's some. You want to have nighttime routine. Dad and mom reading the Bible together. Now, we had a thing where sometimes we would sort of divide and conquer. So I would take one or two kids, and my wife would take one or two. But fortunately, our kids were spaced out so that we could actually both do it as well. Like one kid's bedtime was 8, then another kid's bedtime was 8:30, then another kid's bedtime was 9. And so it took like the whole evening. We were doing nighttime routines with each of our kids. But it really, really pays off. These were good little tools that we used on our nighttime routines. I like that Catherine Voss Bible on the right for kids who are ages 8, 9, 10, 11. It was a real good Bible for them. That Salty's Kids Bible was better for like 2-year-olds to 6 or 7. For older kids, these are really good books you can read. Preparing for Adolescence by James Dobson. Don't Check Your Brains Out at the Door. These are for middle school kids. All kinds of resources here for middle school kids. Prayer routine. So we used to break this book out. This is a kid's book on windows on the world, and it gives each page or two is a chapter on a country. And it gives prayer points that you and your kid can pray through. You read about the culture or the country, and then it gives like 5 or 6 prayer points that you and your kid can pray through. And this teaches your kids how to pray. And it's really cool. It's a good book. I would say this is for ages 8, 7 till 12. Talking, a lot of talking, and some of our kids are really good at this, especially at night because they don't want to go to sleep. And you know what? I would just let them talk. You know, you got 18 years. You've really got only about 12 or 13, 14 years of good talking. Let them talk. Don't be such a stickler on getting them to sleep. You need to talk with them. And my kids, there they are. These are a couple years old. But my kids, we still have this nighttime routine, and it's starting to end now. Of course, Michelle on the left is out of the house, so I don't have a nighttime routine with her. Jenny, who's 18, she's a senior in high school, she still wants me to come and talk to her when she goes to bed. It's awesome. And same with Daniel. Although he's a boy and he's starting to get out of this, he's 15. So I'm telling you, take advantage of this time. Teachable moments. My wife was really good at this. You know, if it's not the nighttime routine, things come up during the day all the time where you have a teachable moment. So my daughter Michelle always, every day, came home completely tied up in knots. She was anxious. And Cindy was really good with, okay, well, you're anxious about this. Here's what God says. Now let's pray. I was not that good at that. I got too impatient. Michelle had friendship issues. And so if she had a fight, my wife would always be like, now, here's what you need to do. You need to go and initiate reconciliation. I think when you see advertising, you should just get on this advertising with your kids. And just show them, expose the advertising for what it really is. That's really fun. Now, I really like to do that. Like, man, what are they really saying here? And that was fun. I probably did it too much because now my kids don't believe anything. They're really cynical about stuff. But it's really good because they can see through stuff. When you're out there in creation beauty, you need to point that out to your kids and show them how cool God is and what He created. And maybe get into a spontaneous 20-second prayer on how cool God is. This all takes time and energy. And if you're too busy, if your lives are too complicated, it's going to be really difficult to take the time to do this stuff. We need to be relational parents on the left there, not competitive parents. And then I think, too, bringing God's kingdom into your home. Hospitality, very important. A family is a door that has hinges and a lock. The hinges should be well oiled to swing the door open. Edith Schaefer, What is a Family? Open up your home. This is like the best thing for your kids. Have people over all the time. Have parties at your house. Let your kids see that you love people. This is an integral part of spiritual formation in your kids. Hospitality is not what we have. It's not fluffing up the pillows and vacuuming the carpet and, you know, having the right kind of coffee or tea. It's who we are as people. Edith Schaefer also said, nothing can substitute for the day-to-day observation on the part of children in the home of a mother or father who truly treat human beings as human beings and not machines. Kids need to see you. Open up your home. What I've seen is a lot of young families hunker down, and they get a little fortress, and they just they don't open up their home, and I think kids are going to suffer. Kids need to see this. I think it'd be good, and I think dads are also better at this, but I think we need to discredit the world system while promoting God's system. So, like, when you see stuff like Tiger Woods, man, you just should jump all over that stuff and say, man, money, look at that. He's ruined his life because of his choices. And then promote God's system. Like, that's a picture of David Robinson. He's this really good pro basketball player, and he's a Christian. He loves the Lord, and he's a really good family man. And, you know, just point these things out. Oh, here's a way to discredit the world system. Have any of you read Randy Alcorn's book? He gave this really cool example here, and I haven't done this yet, and I wish I had done it, but I'm not sure I'm going to get to this because my kids' ages. But check this out. You know, like on family night, here's what you should do. Take a field trip to the dump. Show them all the piles of treasures that were formerly Christmas and birthday presents. Point out things that cost hundreds of dollars that children quarreled about, friendships were lost over, honesty was sacrificed for, marriages broke up over. Show them the miscellaneous arms and legs and remnants of battered dolls, rusted robots, and electronic gadgets that now lie useless after their brief lifespan. Point out to them that most of what your family owns will one day be in the junkyard like this. Read 2 Peter 3, verses 10 through 14, which tells us that everything will be consumed by fire. And you're like, this, kids, is why we're not pursuing what so many of your friends' families are pursuing. This is why. Because these things don't matter. Nice. And finally, help our kids to become givers, not takers. This is real important. I don't have a whole lot here, but awesome words by Jesus Christ. You should remember the words of our Lord Jesus. It's more blessed to give than to receive. I think this falls, so often we're in, you've probably seen these quadrants before, so often we're in that top left category. Something urgent, it's not that important, but it has to be done, and we spend the bulk of our time in that top left category. What we really need to focus on is that bottom right category of not urgent, but important. And I think that's where helping our kids to serve comes in. It usually falls into that quadrant. Gabby Notori's reviewed a number of studies, including the one by Search Institute that involved 47,000 youth. The study showed that youth who regularly volunteer and serve exhibit higher levels of self-esteem, motivation, interest in learning, and moral responsibility. Awesome. If you can get your kids serving, they're going to be healthier people. Kids who serve others just 1 hour or more per week were less likely to be involved in high-risk behavior than those not involved in volunteering. Yeah, get your kids volunteering. They can do the kids program here at Xenos. There's all kinds of volunteer opportunities. All you got to do is get on the web or go to the library and find out. Some ideas? Well, first of all, let's make our kids givers within the family. You know, a lot of us are sort of, I don't know what the term is, but we try to do everything. We don't make our kids do anything. Like, we don't make them do their dishes. We don't make them, you know, we pick up their room after them. I think that's a bad idea. We need to start giving our kids, at a very young age, little things to do and gradually expand on their responsibilities. But again, in a way that isn't going to destroy the relationship. So you don't want to have your 10-year-old kid who has to mow the lawn, you know, do all the laundry for the family, you know. He's going to get pretty resentful. But give them stuff to do within the family. They have a role. At young ages, they have to pick up their toys. I think it's a mistake for mom to be picking up a 2-year-old's toys all the time. And you can turn it into a game. Okay, now it's pick up your toys time. And you can play a fun song, his favorite song, every time you pick up toys. Click on the CD, and that's the time to pick up toys. And so you do it together. Give them family jobs. Maybe help them make you lunches and dinners. Get the little 4-year-old up on the chair, over the stove, helping stir stuff. You want to make them feel important in doing stuff. And get your older siblings learning how to take care of their younger siblings. Make them do this. They need to serve. Also, make them givers outside the family. Again, there's all kinds of ideas like that. Randy Alcorn had some cool ideas. He talked about teaching them to give 10%. And that's even birthdays and Christmas money. And so what he said was you get three jars. You have a giving jar, a spending jar, and a savings jar. And teach them from a very young age that whatever money they get, they should put 10% aside in the giving jar. And they can never take money out of that jar. That is the giving jar. Once they made their decision, they gave their 10%. We just used to make our kids, now you have to give 10%. And we would figure out what that money was, put it in the giving jar. And then let them spend a bunch of that money they get on stuff, but also make them put aside a certain percentage for savings. And once they put it in savings, maybe you can work up some sort of system that they can't really take it out of there, maybe occasionally. But it's a giving jar, a spending jar, and a savings jar. I thought that was a good idea. And then teach kids to wait. Teach them to wait. They don't have to have that thing right then. So those are some ideas, and I guess that's not quite the outline, but that's close. So there you have it, simple living. Any thoughts or questions? Yeah. We've got a mic here, Sherry. Oh.
I have a question about, you know, with kids and spending and having the three jars. We tried that. And I guess my question is with spending, you know, we as parents take care of their needs for the most part, you know, clothes, food, basic needs. And we don't want to teach them to be impulsive spenders. And so what they're going to spend their money on is mainly wants, right? And we don't want to teach them to spend their money just on wants. So how would you guide them in spending their money wisely and not, you know, just spending it on impulse things and things that they want, but being responsible spenders?
Okay, well, I think what I do is I take those other two jars. You've got the giving jar, and that money is history. It's gone. It's in the giving jar. And you as a parent are going to take that giving jar every couple weeks somewhere and let them know what their money went for. You can do little projects together and decide where that money goes. Now, for the other two jars, I would have a jar for impulsive spending. That middle jar could be impulsive spending. But talk through with them and try to reason with them on, are there things you're going to save for? Because oftentimes there's not enough money being put in that middle jar to cover some of the bigger things they would like to have. And so I think if we don't let them spend money, then they're just going to be, well, and then what's the point? And they're going to be really discouraged. So I think you need to let them spend money and teach them that it's their money, they're a steward over that money, and let them spend. Like with my son, we used to let him, he's like a total materialist, but and it's been really a little bit difficult with him. But he used to be this Hot Wheels or this Legos guy. So he would always get the new Lego toy, and he would do certain jobs and take some of his allowance money. And every couple weeks or every month, he would look forward to buying that next Legos box that had all these Lego things in it. And I thought that was a good reward for him, and it gave him some real tangible reasons why he's saving money. But then try to coach them on the other third jar that, now, are there bigger things you want? How about this model car that costs $20, $30? Can we save up for that? And that's going to take, like, 6 weeks.
So savings should be more of a, it could be short-term.
Short-term or long-term.
Not necessarily long-term.
But I think if it's too long-term, they're just going to forget and they're going to get discouraged and it's going to backfire on you. As long as they've got that money in the giving, I think you're in good shape. Because what else is a kid, you know, a five-year-old isn't going to save for a car when he's 16.
Right.
I don't, you know, he's going to save more like for, I don't know,
a bike.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good question.
Another thing that we did to help our kids use spending, their disposable spending money, to think about others is like they would buy gifts for one another, you know, like we had them buy something for their sibling, you know, and then we also, or their dad or mom, and then even like their friends or their teachers or something, like, mm-hmm. because just to try to think about others, like,